WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joseph Timmelty went from the Massachusetts State House to the prison house. After serving 5 terms as a state senator, running for mayor of Boston 3 times, and serving on a housing commission in the administration of President Jimmy Carter, Timmelty was sentenced to 4 months for conspiracy to commit fraud in a condominium development project in which he was a partner. Timmelty has maintained he was guilty of stupidity, signing a contract he didn't fully understand, but not guilty of conspiracy. He served his time at a federal penitentiary in Pennsylvania. He secretly kept a prison journal, which was against the prison rules. With the help of Boston Globe feature writer Jack Thomas, he's adapted it into the new book, Prison Journal. The book also includes his recommendations for prison reform. Timmelty entered prison in early October 1993. I asked him if the prison was mostly for white-collar criminals.
No, not necessarily. The prison I was sent to was for first-time nonviolent offenders. The majority of people who were incarcerated there were first-time drug dealers from Spanish Harlem and from New York, the ghetto of New York and Washington. And white-collar criminals were a vast minority of individuals that were there.
One of your suggestions for prison reform is to create meaningful work for people who are incarcerated. You had to work while you were in prison, and you, in fact, started working in the library. That sounds like it had the potential to be as meaningful as you can get in a prison. Was it meaningful work?
No, what a surprise I got. I asked to go to the library because I thought it would give me an opportunity to further my writing, knowing I was going to do it, or at least attempt to do the journal that we now talk about. So that when I finally achieved my request and got there, I was surprised to find out I was nothing more than a guard sitting behind a desk, making sure that people kept the noise down. There were no books for them to check out. There were no books really for them to read. The only real reading material that you had for 300 men was 1 or 2 USA Todays that came in, and maybe a late Time magazine, and people were asked to check them out so that you'd know exactly who was taking them. And then when you'd look at the book when you came in the morning to see who checked out the reading material for the last night, you'd see names like Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, Frank Sinatra. Nobody would give their right name. It was that the library itself was a joke.
You asked to be transferred from the library. In fact, you asked to be transferred to latrine duty, and I don't know, my first reaction is, who in the world would ask to be transferred from the library to cleaning the latrine? Why did you ask for that transfer?
There was an individual, again from Philadelphia, who was in charge of the discussion group, which was a group of Catholics and Protestants and Jews that got together every Sunday night. He was a very intelligent guy from the Protestant population, and he had that duty before I did.
Which duty, the latrine or the library?
The latrine.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that. And you could see, because he hung around the library when he wasn't in the latrine, you could see that I was very unhappy with the library duty. And he said to me that he was getting ready to go to a halfway house. In other words, he was getting ready to go out of the prison population and go back to Philadelphia to a halfway house. He said that job was coming up. I ought to think about it. And the last thing I'd want is to be cleaning up a latrine. And he said, well, you ought to meet me some morning and see how I do it. And I did. And he said, it takes you basically about an hour to clean this whole facility up. He says, you have the rest of the day to yourself. You're your own boss. And as long as the place is clean, nobody's going to bother, because nobody thinks that anybody can keep this clean. He says, I've been able to do it. He says, this is something you ought to think about, because even though you're sitting all day long in the library, this gives you a whole host of more freedom. Plus, it's not a hard thing to clean. All you need is a pair of gloves and some Lysol. Well, after seeing what he was referring to, I volunteered for that duty. And I was so glad to get out of the library. It was one of the best things that I had done. It gave me much more time to move around the facility. The place was easy to clean. It gave me a chance to kibitz with all kinds of prisoners that were coming by, and by that because the latrine was in the hallway of the administration building. Gave me all kinds of access to different individuals. So he was right. It was a great move for me.
Let me ask you, while you were cleaning the latrine, if there was another prisoner inside who had a grudge against you, would he dirty the latrine to get back at you?
Sure. Your level of intelligence within the populations there was not Harvard on the Charles. Yeah, sure, there were some people who would try to do that. But if I have my gloves and armed with my gloves and my Lysol and my brush, I mean, how much damage can they do to a commode or a urinal or the floor? And if they did that, I'd have to reciprocate in some like manner, and they'd never do it again.
Well, what could you do to reciprocate?
Well, a whole host of things. Make sure that the next time they came needing the latrine, that it would be closed for repair. making sure that they were, the next time they came looking for the latrine, that there was no toilet paper. There were a whole host of things that you could do to meet the demand.
Now, you were in a prison for nonviolent first offenders. Was there much violence inside?
They frowned on violence.
Who's they? The prisoners, the authorities?
The authorities. And any time they witnessed any violence whatsoever, they would react immediately by pulling that person out of the population. But violence was always like a coat of paint. It was like right under the surface all the time. And I was warned when I first got there. I was warned of a lot of things. But one of the key things was suggested to me, Joe, stay out of the TV room. If there's a fight, it's going to happen in two areas, either over the TV or over chow. For example, in the TV room, there was always a great debate as to what station people were going to watch. There was a whole, it's the first time I had ever been introduced to it, by the way. There were a whole combine of Trekkers, people who were absolutely addicted to Star Trek. And anybody that would try to change the station at a time when Star Trek was on, there was going to be a fight.
My guest is former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timmelty. His new book is called Prison Journal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timmelty. His new book, Prison Journal, is about the 4 months he spent at a federal penitentiary in Pennsylvania, serving time for fraud conspiracy related to a real estate development in which he was a partner. Give us a sense of what your daily schedule was like inside.
I'd get up earlier than most because, one, I found that I could do my wash at that time, and the washing machines were empty. So I'd get up around 4:30, realizing everybody else would get up around 6. I also did that because I could get into the bathroom and clean a sink and clean an area. That's the way I was brought up. And then I'd have a head start on the day, and then by the time 6 o'clock came around, when everybody else got up and the chow line opened, I'd be one of the first people over there. And I found breakfast was a pretty good setting. I would be at the breakfast hall for maybe an hour, having a cup of coffee, just sitting talking to the other inmates. Then I would open up the latrine, clean it, be out of there without a rush by 9:30. Then I'd go find some place to write, and that's the end product that we have here. After that, about 11 or 12 o'clock, I'd find a way to get to lunch, and then after lunch, I'd work out for an hour, I'd work out for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then clean up again and go back to my writing. So it was basically like everybody else, it was make work. Find something to do, occupy your time. The main thing I wanted to do every day was to write my journal and also to get a workout so that I'd sleep at night.
Now let me ask you, it sounds like it was an experience with a lot of potential for being meaningless and empty. On the other hand, it doesn't sound like you were suffering terribly within that daily regimen. You know, breakfast, an hour of cleaning, a workout, writing. I've heard a lot worse. Some people criticize these minimum security prisons for nonviolent offenders for being like country clubs. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, it's not a fair criticism. I mean, the big thing with me was I was a prisoner, and I was restricted from being with my family. That, to me, was a total loss. Now, I don't care whether you have me in isolation for 24 hours a day or in the scenario that I just outlined for you. I still don't have an opportunity of being with my family. At night, I stay there. I'm frozen into space for a period of time. I'm restricted from the thing that was most important to me, which was my freedom and my family.
If you could have sentenced yourself to something, I know you think you shouldn't have been found guilty in the first place, but let's say you're found guilty and you had to give yourself some kind of sentence. How would the sentence you gave yourself compare to what you were actually sentenced to?
I'd find some way to have me live at home on some kind of a bracelet and provide public service to community groups, nonprofit groups in the area of expertise that would have them get government grants and be able to get to do government applications for the quickly vanishing federal dollar for community improvement. It'd be one of the ways that that I could have helped them. And then if I did that, I'd have to pay for the bracelet myself. I wouldn't have a disruption of the home life, which in a lot of cases is devastating to families.
But I think the public wants to see a white-collar criminal suffer for his crime, to be punished in a way that hurts.
Well, then I think that we look at the outcome. First of all, for a white-collar criminal like myself, the day I was indicted, my reputation was through for the rest of my life. It doesn't make any difference if they sent me away for 5 days or 5 years. It doesn't improve or deprove my reputation. It's already gone. The day I'm found guilty by a jury, I'm devastated as a white-collar criminal. Now, if I'm a banker, that means I'm never able to bank again. If I'm a lawyer, that means I'm never able to be a lawyer again. If I'm a doctor, that means I'm never able to doctor again. So, I mean, how much punishment do you want to have effect? Why punish the taxpayers along with the individual?
After your 4 months inside this minimum security prison, you were sent to a halfway house. Now, ironically, this was a halfway house that you helped establish in spite of protests by residents of the community who were afraid that the halfway house would bring a kind of criminal dangerous element into the neighborhood. Tell me first why you supported this controversial halfway house.
Well, I've always believed in alternative sentencing, and if you're going to have those kinds of alternatives, then they should be located within the community. I mean, you can't isolate them. The place that, that we're referring to was an old Mariner Hotel that had seen it better days and was in disrepair. It seemed to me to be a perfect setting for a halfway house. It was across the street from the YMCA. It was downtown Boston. It was availability of jobs. It had all of the kinds of assets that you'd want for a population that was trying to get back into society.
You had mentioned that you feel as soon as you were convicted that your reputation was ruined and much of your professional life was over. What kind of work are you doing now?
I work as a lobbyist. I represent clients at the State House in Massachusetts.
So your professional life was not totally ruined by the conviction?
Well, let's let your listeners decide that. I was an elected official for somewhere around 18 years. I put my name in the ballot, and most time I was unopposed. And now my life has changed so that I now represent racetracks at the Massachusetts legislature. Now, I think that's a far cry from being an elected official.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry.
Joseph Timmelty's new book is called Prison Journal.